The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Well, now it's time to go through the Sunday newspapers. I'm joined by Jack Horgan-Jones. But first of all, I will give you the headlines on the front pages. A doctor says CAMHS caused systemic homicide of kids, which is a startling and disturbing headline on the Irish Mail on Sunday. The Business Post, historic low. This is reflecting on a poll they have. Economic fears fuel black backlash against the coalition. The Sunday Independent, number of super rich in Ireland doubles in 5 years. And Shane Ross is writing inside about financial novices Harrison Chambers are holding the purse strings of a precarious economy. At the Sunday Times, homeowners warned on a rush to build cabins, and McDonald defies hints of Sinn Féin discontent. At the Red Top, said the Irish Sunday People, NHS picks up record private patients in crisis. The Mirror, Dan Deal, this is suggesting that the weight of evidence is so strong against Daniel Kinnan that he may well plead guilty, an unlikely scenario, I would have thought. And The Sun on Sunday concentrates on the jungle and the goings-on there, which I must confess I have not been following. Jack Horgan-Jones, what have you been concentrating on? The political matters, I'm sure.
Yes, so keeping an eye to the political news of the day, and obviously that poll, the Red Sea poll in the Business Post, gives us our most readily at hand headline, and the numbers, just to quickly run through them: Sinn Féin at 25%, up 1, Fianna Fáil 16, no change, Fine Gael down 2 to 16, Independents level on 12, Sock Dems on 8, Independent Ireland up 2 points, interestingly, to 7, Aintu on 6, Labour no change on 4, Green no change on 3, Fine Gael down 2 to 16.
16, okay.
Yeah, so look, a lot of, and everything that we're seeing there is within the margin of error. So it's not a seismic poll for anyone. But once you kind of take a step back and look at the trends that are being suggested since the general election, that's when a picture begins to emerge, which is more clear. And Dan Murray does that in his poll analysis on page 6 and 7 of the Business Post, where he reports that since the 2024 general election, Fine Gael has now fallen 5 points in this polling series, while Fianna Fáil has fallen 6 points. So that is, as Dan writes, a hefty 11-point decline between them. And what's interesting is that while Sinn Féin has grown up 6 points since the election and is the most popular party in the state, both in this polling series and in others, there is a fair degree of speculation and discussion, and indeed behind-the-scenes criticism from within Sinn Féin itself of the strategic direction of the party under its current leader, Mary Lou McDonald, as the party gathered in Belfast this weekend for its Ard Fhéidh.
And she was quite defiant and saying, you know, I don't feel I'm threatened, da-da-da, looking forward to campaigning in the by-elections. If they don't put up a good showing in the by-elections, there could be consequences. But, I mean, who's the pretender? Is it Pearce?
Well,
and do you have to get the okay of Belfast if there's to be a heave against Mary Lou?
That's the perennial piece of theorising around Sinn Féin, you know, that the quote-unquote shadowy figures in West Belfast will be making the call, something that the party itself obviously disputes. Pearse Doherty and Matt Carthy are the two names that are you know, discussed most frequently. I think that the problems for Sinn Féin are perhaps more deep than might be addressed by a simple change of leader, particularly a change of leader to someone like Pearce or Matt, who have been to the fore of the more aggressive approach that the party has taken since the last election. Jen Bray, the political editor of the Sunday Times, has a very good read on Sinn Féin in that paper this weekend, where unusually enough, there are critics, albeit unnamed critics, of Mary Lou McDonald giving voice to a view within the party that it is now not a case of if, but of when. And they do point to the potential negative result for the party in both the Dublin Centre by-election and in the Galway West by-election as a potential trigger for not a heave, but something of a more orderly transition.
I mean, there is the issue of Mary Lou is Dublin-based and Pearce is Donegal-based. I mean, can you see a Pearce or a Matt Carthy actually leading a government? Because it doesn't look likely that that could happen.
I mean, this is the point I was kind of coming to, although just as a brief aside, it is interesting when you look into the Red Sea numbers that a lot of the growth in support for Sinn Féin seems to be coming from kind of Connacht, Ulster, those kind of areas, as opposed to within Dublin. I think that the problem for Sinn Féin is not necessarily that it is plateauing, albeit as the most popular party. It's like I can't see where the engine of growth comes from for Sinn Féin. Like, what is the strategy that an alternate leader might credibly propose to its membership?
But you have people stealing their clothes all the time. I mean, you've the Sock Dems stealing part of their garments. And then on the other hand, you've Independent Ireland. For those who might, I suppose, demur with the Sinn Féin policy on immigration and so on, heading in that direction.
And that is very neatly expressed in the Dublin Central and Galway West by-elections, where you would think, the largest party of opposition in by-elections where government candidates effectively never win, you would think Sinn Féin is going to be best positioned to take one or both of those seats. But in Dublin Central, they are vulnerable, I think, most particularly to the kind of soft left, the Social Democrats candidate there, Councillor Daniel Ennis, is seen as building up a reasonable head of steam. And if he can kind of stay in touch, then other parties of the centre left, particularly the Greens and Labour, if they don't get into contention themselves, would transfer to him. So that's the kind of threat on the party's left flank. But the squeeze, and again, this is in Jen Bray's piece in the Sunday Times, the squeeze is also coming on from the right. So if you look in Galway West, the former Fianna Fáil candidate or councillor down there, Noel Thomas, now with Independent Ireland, he looks to be polling quite strongly, and he will draw from a large base of potentially disaffected Fianna Fáil votes as well. He will also do well, you would imagine, amongst that kind of rural conservative vote. There is an independent candidate down there who is aligned with the kind of Noel Grealish machine. But if he doesn't get into contention, then you'd imagine some of his vote might drift towards Noel Thomas as well. So that illustrates that the Sinn Féin candidate down there may be struggling to stay ahead of a threat on the party's right flank. And so those two contests that we're going to see now within a month kind of express neatly the difficulties facing Sinn Féin, despite its
polling. If they don't take a seat, either or both of those seats, I mean, does that elevate the threat to Mary Lou, or is she right that she is secure?
I think it does. There's no two ways about it. Like, Mary Lou McDonald is probably the most talented campaigning politician of her generation. And I think that we've seen that, particularly in the 2020 and 2024 general elections, 2020, where Sinn Féin were the winners of the election that didn't end up in government, and 2024, where they pulled back from a really abysmal low in the local and European elections and saved their blushes. But the common thread is that after two general elections and a host of local and European elections, Mary Lou McDonald has not made good on the promise to lead Sinn Féin in government in Dublin and see the party also in leading government in Belfast and make good on progress on what is the core of the entire Sinn Féin political project, which is not a particular set of policies from left or indeed right, it's Irish unity. And a failure to deliver that time and again across multiple electoral cycles, notwithstanding her talent as a campaigner and as a performer in the Dáil, I think it is inevitable that any political organisation would ask questions of their leadership. But to return to a point I was making a little while ago, Where's the credible alternative? Who is able to credibly say to Sinn Féin members and the wider electorate, here is where this party is going, here is what is going to do in government, deliver that in a compelling way that mobilises support back to a level where maybe it was in the midpoint between the 2020 and 2024 general elections?
Isn't there always a problem when people are forever in opposition and they have to keep on making the same noises, the same speeches, which is generally not to cooperate with government? I mean, the duty of the opposition is to oppose and to challenge and to interrogate government policies. But that you kind of sound like you're repeating your bleating. Do you know what I mean? And people get tired of it.
Well, I mean, as someone who has to sit through leaders' questions once or twice a week, you know, it is very much a case of rinse and repeat. You know, if it's not scoliosis, it's the cost of living, and like, there are obviously extremely meritorious topics for attention, but they do seem to be more or less interchangeable week in, week out. But I suppose that, you know, you can abstract from that where the opposition thinks the government's weak points are. And one of them obviously is the cost of living, and there's some interesting stuff
on the cost of living in the papers today.
So we'll stick with the Business Post for the time being. John Rogers, who is an associate director at Red Sea, the polling company, has a piece on page 7 talking about the disconnect between the GDP boom and then the squeezed reality. So we saw this during the week. We had those incredible surplus figures coming out on Wednesday, where the surplus, which everyone had expected would go down due to the raid that the government has undertaken on cost of living, actually went up by the projected surplus went up by 4 billion. Now we're going to be something like 9 billion. So people are seeing these headline figures. They're seeing the ongoing, the boom getting boomier in the FDI sector, but they are feeling much more pressure on their household finances, you know, being able to meet the cost of living day to day. And that is the political dynamic.
And then you get the international straw in the wind with Meta cutting 10% of its global workforce and how that will impact in Ireland. It will to some extent.
Reminds everyone of the vulnerability of those corporation tax figures. But meanwhile, the government has this huge surplus, and it looks to be, and there's an interesting spread on this across page 6 and 7 of the Mail on Sunday, where John Drennan has the political read of the week in that paper, and they're talking about a plan that seems to be in gestation in the Department of Finance with Fine Gael leader Simon Harris, which is looking to kind of structurally adjust the way electricity bills are taxed in Ireland. It seems to be, it's quite nascent, so we don't have a huge amount of detail, but what John is writing about seems to be basically stripping away a lot of the taxes that are levied to pay for the grid and renewables and so on at the bill level, and shifting the focus of paying for that from the consumer of electricity to the exchequer, and therefore structurally lowering the price of energy to consumers in a way that the government has not done so far.
Do the big boys, the data centres and so on, do they pay those contributions proportionately as well, I wonder? Because if you strip it away from the households and you also strip it away from the big users, the cement manufacturers and so on, if they're paying those levies, well then, you know, it puts a huge onus on government, because they may not pay the taxes we want them to pay. And yet, you know, so I'm wondering if that transfer makes sense. It's going to have to be paid for one way or the other. The easiest way is to levy the punter.
The easiest way is to levy the punter. But this piece in the Mail kind of reflects some of the conversations I've been having with people in government across the last little while, where there is a growing sense of doubt that the model that Ireland has, and I'm not an expert in energy markets, so I'll hold back from pronouncing on exactly how it works, but certainly what people are saying to me is that the model that Ireland has, whereby you pay for the transition through higher costs on consumers, but even though proportionally they may be lower on large energy consumers than they are on households, that's not structurally appropriate for a world where you've shifted to a higher cost of energy and electricity.
And we did look,
and if that's lasting, you might need to look at recalibrating.
We looked at the
energy
market on the program a couple of weeks back, and the way we charge or we pay for our power. You get maybe cheap green power for the first whatever, then you reach peak and you have to bring in some gas generators. They get paid top dollar. But because they get paid top dollar, everybody gets paid top dollar. And it seems insane to me as a way of doing business, because you get no bargain, therefore, from your cheaper energy.
Yeah, and I think that this all derives from Europe to an extent. Yeah. I think that it's a European approach to dictate the cost of electricity by reference to gas. And when you have a lot of gas in your system, particularly when it has to kick in a peaking capacity to make up for your renewables when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing, that can have a big impact on the cost of electricity for the punter, for the consumer.
Yeah, because everyone gets paid the same, even if they're generating it for half nothing, because the winds are blowing and your windmills have been up for 10 years and already paid for. You don't get that bargain price. Anyway, anything else? I see across the... I'm not sure whether you've read this article yet. Homeowners warned on rush to build cabins.
Yes.
This is about the bed in the shed in the back garden. And if you do it too quickly before the rules are out, you might get takedown notices.
This is the front page of the Sunday Times. Like, this has been a really... It's sparked so much discussion, this idea, the beds and sheds, or the shed sits, as they were branded in it all this week. And it's kind of... It's really split people. So either you think this is, you know, an innovative approach to solving one part of the housing crisis, or you think it is a damning indictment of the inability to address the housing crisis.
It's both.
I like to have it both ways. Yeah, I think it is both, you know. I was talking to one person during the week who made the observation that, like, if we lived in a normal country, this would be a great idea. But given the country that we do live in, it's going to be a disaster because people are going to throw up anything and everything. I think it'll be quite popular within, you know, one segment of the electorate. I think it will be quite popular as well, particularly for that group of people who have, you know, effectively no chance of owning their own home, but now might be able to drop 80 or 90 grand on building a decent modular unit in the back garden. It needs to be a big enough back garden, it must be said, and have an independent life independent from their family. But, you know, there will be stories of anything and everything getting thrown up and people living in pretty, pretty bad conditions. So,
Jack Horgan-Jones, thank you very much for joining us and running us through this morning's papers.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.